some flashing.
LMC. You're listening to the LMC Radio Network, broadcasting out of Forestville, California, on the World Wide Web at LuckyMojo.com.
I don't think we can hear Art, but I'm going to start the music, everybody. Let's build that energy. Welcome to Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places, exploring the magical world around us, only on the LMC Radio Network. There are so many fantastic, exciting, and curious things that make up this world we share. Come join us as we explore the spiritual, magical, and wondrous phenomena that enrich our souls and bring color to our days. I am your announcer, Reverend James of FolkConjure.com, located in Western North Carolina. This week, we welcome our special guest, Doc Murphy of RootDocMurphy.com in Paganistan and the Twin Cities of Minnesota, bringing us today's topic, culture and magic. In just a moment, we'll be joined by our host, Reverend Art of FolkConjure.com in North Carolina, and our guest, Doc Murphy. Make sure you're logged into Blog Talk Radio and join in the discussion via the chat. Now let's catch up with our host, Reverend Art. Take it away. Oh, no, we still don't have Reverend Art, I don't think.
Art, are you there? Can you hear me?
All right, so he's going to, yes, we can hear you, Doc Murphy. Hello, everybody. This is Doc
Murphy.
Everyone. We'll go ahead and bring her in. How are you doing?
Well, you know, best laid plans. Got home in plenty of time to log in, and I have a new phone, and none of my headsets are compatible. So in a beautiful technological shit show here, I am just holding the phone up to my ear in order to talk to anybody. So I won't be in the chat much because I can't type, but I'm looking at all of you in the chat. So, how are you, James?
That seems to be a common occurrence, it seems, with Reverend Art not being able to connect via the direct connect instead of calling in. That's why his voice has been so clear lately on the radio, because he's got a really good mic for his computer. So, yeah, we're having technical difficulties here, too. Beyond that, it's starting to cool off here in Western North Carolina. We're getting a little bit of rain every once in a while, a few little scattered thunderstorms. So it's starting to cool things off a little bit. It's been really hot. And at Folk Conjure and FolkFaithMinistries.com, we are finally moving everything over. Mystics and Mages is getting moved tonight. And we're going to be on all new servers. So for those of you who are our clients or our potential guests that have been having any email difficulties, that should very soon be remedied. I think we have Reverend Art on the line. Are you there?
Talk about a technological shit show. You know, it started out phenomenally, and Doc Murphy, I think I caught the bug. I don't know what happened.
Sorry.
But I'm here.
Yeah, and Mercury is not retrograde.
Fun.
Yeah, Venus is retrograde right now, but Mercury isn't. So,
Well, I'm definitely not feeling the technological love today. I'll tell you what. All right. Well, my apologies for my somewhat late arrival, everybody. Just wanted to do a quick shout out because it is Monday, and Monday is Magic Mondays on Hoodoo Psychics. Make sure you go out to the Hoodoo Psychics Facebook page, drop a comment on their Magic Mondays post, and get entered to win a free 15-minute reading with the Hoodoo Psychic of your choice. That is a $60 value, folks. Can't go wrong. A lot of great folks out there. You'll find Reverend James. You'll find Doc Murphy. You'll find our friend JD, who was our guest last week and here supporting us tonight, and myself as well, among many others. Miss Cat is there, Deacon Millett. Wonderful lineup. Go get your chance to win. You know, I'm sitting here looking at all the technology on my desk going, which one of these things am I supposed to be talking into? Because I can hear from one, I can talk into another. This is not my forte.
Yeah.
But,
and I'm in the same thing. I'm like, look at all these headsets. Look at all the Bluetooth. Look at all that. Why isn't anything talking to each other? So, oh, well, we'll make do.
That we will. And, you know, I for one, and thank you, Reverend James, for covering for me and keeping it from going dead air right there after the intro.
I'm not great at improvisation, but I think I did okay.
You did perfect. It was fine. But I, for one, am very excited tonight to have Doc Murphy joining us again. We had such a phenomenally lively discussion the last time Doc Murphy joined us. I can't help but believe that this is going to be just another phenomenal event. So I know I kind of heard through one of these devices. Reverend James gave us a little bit of an update on us. How are things going, other than technologically, up there in Paganistan, Doc Murphy?
Oh, well, it is the beautiful part of summer here up in Minnesota and Paganistan. We had our big old heat wave last week where, you know, the heat index got up to over 100 and people were melting. But now we've hit that kind of nice mid-80s, which makes my little Mediterranean heart happy. And it is, we're rolling to the latter part of pagan festival season. I just got back from Fire Circle about a week and a half ago. Hay River Fire Haven, the pagan church that I am affiliated with, hosts an event every year called the Alchemical Fire Circle. And I just got back from that, and that's, well, you know, worth explaining. It's a three-night working, alchemical working, where kind of we engage physically and spiritually and work through three nights until the sun comes up to shake off our dross and come out of this gold. And it didn't disappoint. They're always intensives. They're spiritual intensives. That said, we had a lot of new young people this year, which makes all of us middle-aged people and elders really happy. We had a multi-generational turnout. But with multi-generational spiritual pursuits also comes generational miscommunications, you know. different ways to do spirituality, different questions and things. So, you know, but that also comes with Fire Circle too, is you want to kind of, you know, engage your, punch through your negativity in order to come out of it more refined. So it was, again, an excellent Fire Circle. And I mean, we can talk a little bit more about that if you feel so inclined sometime. I am on my way next week to another week-long festival that's been here in the Minnesota, Wisconsin area, Paganistan, for a very long time. It's called Sacred Harvest Festival, and a pagan group called Harmony Tribe puts it on. And I attended their festival during my dissertation days. Had to take a break from festing when I was pursuing a career, and now I'm back doing it again. And they've asked me to come as a guest of honor for the week, where I'm going to be presenting workshops and content as an honored guest again, which is really wonderful because they were so generous letting me run around interviewing them when I was a dissertator, when I was in grad school. And now they're asking me to come back and, you know, share content and be part of the tribe again. So that'll be next week, and I'll be away doing that. So I'm definitely getting my summer in. I have a wonderful tan from all the camping I'm doing. And, re-meeting old folks that I've missed and making new beautiful friends too. So that's what's been happening up in Paganistan. It's been out in the sun and camping a lot and getting spiritual.
You know, and I know that regular listeners of the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour have heard about the wonderful news that has come out of Paganistan, that you were previously, when you were with us, you were still working on the 401c3.
Well, the 501c3. Yeah. Way back, right before COVID hit in 2020, I was approached by an old friend of mine who is an archivist by training, who's also long in the pagan community and a Fire Circle sister. And she said, have you thought about collecting and archiving the history of the pagan community, not just in Minnesota, but like maybe countrywide? And I said, well, I think about it all the time. I don't know how to get it started. And she said, oh, I know how to get it started. She's been in nonprofits since she's in her late 30s, and she's been in them since she was 14. And she said, I know how to do that part. I need someone who can write. And I went, is the Pope Catholic? So we began by working with a pagan nonprofit, a different one here in town, and to apply for grants from the Minnesota Historical Society to start getting grant money to collect oral histories and to start a digital archive of the pagan community. And we were successful twice. We have since opted out of working with another nonprofit, and the Cultural Archive of Modern Paganism, the acronym CAMP, is now its own 501c3. We're in the process of applying for grants again soon. And we're going to be, again, back at it, collecting the oral histories of our community members. And my partner is working diligently to get support for document archives. And our big dream is that, you know, the big goal is that it will be a searchable digital archive, digital database that will be available online to anybody who wants to, for oral histories of the pagan community, archived documents, newsletters, correspondences, media, anything that kind of, you know, is about the history of paganism. First in Minnesota, because we're here, but we're going to be also, you know, eventually training people in other states who want to take this up, to eventually make a nationwide, a searchable digital archive on the history of the Cultural Archive of Modern Paganism. So we kind of went through some dips and ups and downs, and of course I had some medical issues I had to contend with, but about 2 months ago, we officially got the letter, and CAMP is a 501c3 nonprofit. So we can just apply and pursue, and we are kind of our own entity now, and we're crazy excited and ready to get back to work.
You know, that's just absolutely amazing. I mean, I know, you know, a lot of work goes into the books and pamphlets and workshops and everything that members of the communities around the nation, around the world, you know, a lot of effort goes into those, but to have a just a singular source of research and connection and such, I can't think of really a more phenomenal event. You know, it's the, so what you've put together, it, very much congratulations and thank you for myself and for the many others that will benefit from these efforts. And I'm just going to say, if you decide that you want to start doing some research down here in the Appalachian region, come on down. We got a guest room ready.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely want to get as many places as possible. And kind of what we're hoping is that, you know, we have a training method that we created with the first grant. What we're hoping is that we can come visit or communicate otherwise and be able to train young social scientists interested in the pagan community or enthusiastic pagans in their own community to how to do oral history interviews and how to do document archiving. And so they can, knowing the histories of their own respective communities where they are, would be able to kind of tailor local research to wherever they are. You know, we've been in communication with folks in California, with folks in on the East Coast that are very interested in, you know, what people want to do is pack up all their stuff and mail it to us. And we're like, no, we can't do that yet. We can't do that yet. No, we're not cleaning out your closets for you yet. There's a method to this that is you know, professional and museum grade that we're doing here. We're not just kind of throwing things in a box and putting them on a website. We're doing this the way that a museum would do it. And yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to come visit. Any excuse to see my friends down in Appalachia, and I'll bring some Paganistan magic with me. And oh, that would be exciting. That'll be so much fun.
And you know, we can go see our fellow air member and friend Heidi Holton play some of her amazing blues music while you're here as well.
She and I should jam together. That would be fun.
I'd buy a ticket. But, you know, this really is a cool thing. And when you talk about, you know, collecting the pagan histories and such, does that also include, like, you know, the folklore, the folk history sort of thing? Or are you specifically kind of targeting, like, say, druids and, you know, Wicca and things of that nature? Or are we more further abreast than that?
Further
I think Troll T said in the chat a good way to summarize that of what culture means to this organization and its coverage.
Oh, I'd be happy to start with that, seeing as how I am a cultural anthropologist. Culture, in the very kind of basic definition, is patterns of learned behavior that are systematized and that are passed down. The important thing about culture is that it is what of human beings is learned behavior. It is not a cultural marker, anything about how you look biologically or any sort of biological propensity. That's not where culture resides. That's a whole other scientific discipline. Culture is what human beings learn and teach each other and create systems in order to continue to learn and absorb and then pass down and pass down and pass down. So if you think of things like art and clothing traditions, languages, customs, food and traditional food,
music.
These are all things that we learn and then pass down. And those are the things that make it culture. And then pass down, you know, more than one generation, because that's what the difference is between sort of like a lifestyle or a trend or a phenomenon and an actual cultural phenomenon, is that you see generational learning and passing down. So what we're doing with camp is, well, first off, we're letting the people who are telling their oral histories, their own story, talk about whatever they want. And I am making a deliberate focus that it's not just focus on on Wicca or Druidry or heathenry or whatever else. We are, what's nice about these legacy grants that we get is that each little grant that we get, that we apply for, we focus on a particular project for that period of 6 months. So the first grant we got, I collected the oral histories of elders in the community that kind of ranged through all sorts of traditions, but they were folks, these were folks who were kind of on the ground with the beginnings of some of the organizations here in Paganistan, and wanted to make sure that they got their stories because, you know, our elders are eldering, and we actually lost one. We had one ready to set up for an interview with the first round, and he got very ill very quickly, and he died before we got to interview him. His wife managed to get his signature on the release form, and then we lost him 2 days later. We had his wife and his sister tell his story on his behalf, but that was sort of the focus of that one, was just elders in the community, people who have long histories. And then the next batch of oral histories is going to be one particular organization, and then another particular organization, and then when we're going to focus on Druids, and we're going to focus on IFA communities in here. So there are all these little pieces that we can focus on a little bit at a time, a little grant at a time, so that we make this mosaic, which is what a pagan community is. It's a constellation style community where, you know, each little star is kind of its own community. But when you step back, you see the connections that make the community a constellation that makes the meaning even larger. I'm being very deliberate because the pagan communities aren't just bounded by one particular tradition. We have bunches of them here. And also we have to get the stories of people that are unaffiliated, like myself, or who are polyaffiliated, which is a word that I made up when I was doing research, where there are people that are parts of and initiated in and community with all sorts of different traditions. We have a lot of heathen witches, for example. We have a lot of people who are initiated in Wicca and in Druidry and are involved with the heathen community and practice Shinto and, you know, do Reiki, and they just pile it on. In other parts of the world, that's considered pretty normal. You can add on as many. You're not releasing your old religion if you pick up a new one. You just keep adding them on, and all religions have ashe. They all have power. Westerners are preoccupied with, well, you're either this or you're that, and you need to make up your mind. And, like, those of us that are in folk religion mode are like, no, you don't. No one else does in the world. So that's my focus, is to make sure that the scope is as broad as possible. And then, of course, when we get, data from the nation, there's going to be, even more regional idiosyncrasies, too. So I absolutely am making sure that we spread the net really, really wide.
You know, I don't think I could say it any more succinctly than what Phyllis Margaret Gabor has shared in the chat. Is this just sounds so fucking cool.
Well, we're digging it.
So thrilled. It's going to evolve. I know it's very early in stages, and I know it's going to evolve and continue to grow. And I really just want to say congratulations on the achievement of obtaining that 501, but also in really bringing this to light, to bringing all of this together. You made a really big point, about how Westerners are very concerned with you are this or you are that. And then, yeah, there's those of us in the folk, the folk traditions that are like, what?
Right.
it's a phenomenal undertaking, but the end result is going to be truly amazing. I do want to make sure that we dedicate as much time as possible to our topic for tonight. I could talk with you all day long, Doc Murphy, and really, I love when you show up on the show. It's kind of like, a kid in a candy store for me and everybody that has burning questions for you. So, Reverend James, why don't we go ahead and we'll jump into the messages from our sponsors, And then we're going to jump into our talks on culture and magic.
The LMC Radio Network is a media alliance whose excellent shows include The Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rework Hour with Catherine Ironwood and Conjurement, Sundays 3 to 4:30, Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places with Reverend Art and Reverend James, Mondays 4 to 5:30, The Crystal Silence League Hour with John St. Germain, Instant Indication, Tuesdays, The Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron with Elvira Love and Deborah Voigt, Tuesdays 4 to 5, and The Witch, the Priestess, and the Cauldron with Elvira Love and Phoenix LaFay in syndication, Thursdays. All time specific, add 3 hours for Eastern, sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com.
Support for this program is provided by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, and located online at luckymojo.com, and by the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, AIR, a directory of ethical and authentic conjure practitioners located online at readersandrootworkers.org, and by Hoodoo Psychics, the first psychic line run entirely by Hoodoo practitioners. Receive a reading with a trusted rootworker instantly. Call 1-888-4-HOODOO or visit hoodoopsychics.com. And by the Crystal Silence League, a free online prayer service of the Association of Independent Spiritual Churches located online at crystalsilenceleague.org. Thank you to all of our sponsors. Back to you, Reverend Art.
And hopefully everybody can still hear me after the break.
Yes, we can.
Right before
I hear you.
Excellent. Not that I was trying to play with any of the technology, because I'm just looking at it and assuming it's all broken. But right before we went to break, Troll T asked a very good question for you, Doc Murphy, in the chat. What can people do to be a part of your project? And I really like the point that he made as well. Western participants want identity delineation so they can figure out who to convert and to what. Living in Western North
bingo.
Carolina, I truly kind of feel the pressure of that one.
Yeah, bingo. Hit the nail right on the head there. If you are interested in being part of the project, right now the thing to do is we are still setting up ways for people to contact us, social media thingies and official contacts. This being a new 501c3 means we have to kind of get everything all set up all over again. So we will reach out and let people know when you can reach out and kind of follow us along. We do take financial donations of any kind. Any money that's donated to a camp makes us less grant dependent and can be used for things like, you know, travel expenses, tech buy-up, anything that might come up that, you know, will keep us less grant dependent to get things done. So definitely we'll be happy to take 501c3 donations, which, you know, if it's 501c3, you get a tax deduction. But right now we're still in the setup phase, so that when people reach out and say they want to help or they want to be involved, there's places for people to go. So definitely keep people posted on that. But in the meantime, while you're waiting, you know, go through your closets and talk to your communities and say there is a couple of social scientists in Minnesota who are getting this thing started. You know, what do we want to make sure that we preserve in our community? What's important? And, you know, we always stress that, like, you know, it's not an interrogation, it's oral histories, which means everyone's story is going to be different that participates in the culture, and that's what we want. So just to think in terms of, you know, talking to your communities and, you know, if you have saved things over the years, keep saving them. And like I said, we'll, once we get all kind of everything set up with regard to, contact and all that other incredible business, that we've had to start over doing, we will let people know. But in the meantime, just, talk to your communities and pass on that there's a project that's happening, and let's look at what we want to preserve. So.
You know, I truly believe in this project so much. It does relate to our topic of culture and magic tonight. But I do want to say, once everything is up and running, definitely let me know. Come on back to Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places. We will do an entire episode on camp and continue this to help grow this project. I really am impressed.
Thank you so much. And you know, when that day comes, I will like ask my research partner, Velvet Capone, to join us on the show. And then she can talk about the archive part of it, you know, and like I said, that would be a fun show too, because she'd make good radio.
And what's the best contact point for camp right now?
We don't have an official one yet. Like I said, we had one when we were affiliated with the other nonprofit. That since has been taken down. But if folks, eventually we'll let you folks know about any, social media outlets. I will reach out to my research partner about that aspect. She's just applied for a grant in order to start setting that stuff up. So if we get the grant money, which we're fairly confident we will, because they kind of, Minnesota Historical Society has been happy with our work. When we get that grant money, that's partly what some of the grant money that she's applying for this time around is going to fund setting up. So once everything gets rolling, with regard to places to reach out and online things, we will definitely let you know. Right now, we have to build the foundation again and then set things up again. So I will keep you all posted for sure.
And I will definitely share it out on all of our available resources. So for those that are listening that are interested in donating and, you know, really being a part to bringing this further along and further into fruition, make sure you're following Mages and Magical Places on Facebook and Instagram, and any information that Doc Murphy is able to share with me, we will definitely be blasting it out there as soon as we get our hot little hands on it. So let's talk
Thank
culture
so
and magic, Doc Murphy.
All right. So
I'll turn it over to you.
Two enormous topics that we're linking together here. As I kind of mentioned earlier in the
this is what we do
in our conversation. Yeah. I'm sorry.
So this is what we do. We bring huge topics, and then it's like, okay, well, now we have to do a part two show.
Yes. And then part three, and then part four. And then we just keep talking. As I said earlier in the conversation, culture, in the broadest definition, are those things of human existence that are learned, taught, systematized, and passed down. And they're the ephemeral parts of what it means to be human, and also the parts of humanity that are where meaning is imbued. And culture is a particularly funny human creation, because, you know, it's entirely made up. When you get right down to it, the things that make up human cultures around the world, the things that we give meaning to, the stories we create, the traditions we create, why things are beautiful, why things are ugly, why things are dangerous, why things are clean, all of those things really are, when you get right down to it, created in the heads of human beings. And at the same time, it's how we biologically adapted to the pressures of our natural environment. And this is a little baby anthropology lecture here. In order to survive the biological pressures put on us as two-legged primates with not much defense, and kind of a narrow band of you know, climate that we can kind of live in, we created this thing called culture. And while we had technology and the observation of the natural world that we absolutely needed to follow, and we had instincts to answer to. Culture is how we make those things meaningful, and by making them meaningful, we either value them or dismiss them. And then as I said, systematize them, learn them, and teach them so that we preserve them. And then by preserving those things and ascribing meaning to them, we create culture in order to survive our natural environment. Our biological adaptive mechanism as humans is to create institutions of meaning, which is what culture is. And that's where it gets kind of wickety-stickety and fascinating in anthropology, is because you simultaneously have to study the biological reality of what it is to be these very strange two-legged primates that we are, with big brains and way too much time on our hands sometimes, but also have to study these things called cultures around the world, which are powerfully impactful on human existence. But when you get right down to it, you have to extract how they were created and how meaning was created, because really, when you get right down to it, culture is made up stuff. That said, sometimes people create cultural ideas that are so powerful that we forget that we made them up, you know. Things like, well, we kind of hear it in arguments today that get politicized. You know, when you hear people say things like, you know, the silly things like, you know, marriage has always been between a man and a woman, and that's the way it always been. Well, no, that actually it hasn't. It hasn't. But the belief that it was always that way is such a powerful idea that people don't realize that human beings made it up once. They think that it's somehow, you know, factually based. So it's culture is it's why it's so fascinating to study, is because every part of the world looks at the world, the people around the world look at the world differently, depending on where they are and what their pressures are and what's meaningful around them and how to survive.
And the time period.
Right, exactly. All sorts of things, all sorts of factors. And then what you have to do is study the ascription of meaning that people around the world give to their special circumstance, where they are, when they are, how they are, and how they preserve it. And naturally, as a result of that, cultures are going to be diverse around the world, because different cultures and different places in the world have different priorities.
Right.
An example that I like to give is, you know, the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, their most important value is to live in harmony with the natural world as much as you possibly can. And you have to make decisions for the people, knowing that that's the most important value of the culture. Now, a culture like that is not going to invent a rocket ship that goes to the moon, right? You look at our culture, where things like innovation and punching out of what we perceive to be a natural relationship with our natural environment, or in some horrifying cases where they see the natural environment as the enemy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The value is going to be to create all these, you know, technological advances that push us out of being interwoven with the natural environment too much. Now, both cultures have something to learn from each other. We certainly could have a healthier relationship with the natural world around us, and that would be something we could learn from the Aboriginal Australian people. But likewise, there's plenty of them who would love to have access to disease cures and education and that sort of thing that we have. And oftentimes when cultures come together and competing ideas about what's important come into play, some interesting cultural syncretisms can happen. And sometimes they're enforced, sometimes they're agreed upon, sometimes they avoid each other. These things are ideas and customs and languages and all these things are what help people hang together, believing that they're one people. And they're also the things that push people apart. We're these people, those are those people, and we're, you know, we're different than they are. So if you really get into the roots of studying what culture consists of, that's why there's so many theoretical constructs when you become an anthropologist, to try to figure out how do human beings' minds come up with these things, and you know, what are the things that we engage in that ascribe meaning, and you know, what do we use them for versus what other cultures don't, and what's meaningful and what's not. You know, a lot of comparison, but also a lot of sitting and going, why do human beings think this way or feel this way or create these things when other creatures around the world, while social, don't seem to either have the capacity or have the interest the way that we do. So that's your anthropology lecture about culture there. And
you know,
the three
thing, I followed everything you've said so far. And
okay.
I don't know if I ever told you that I do have a slight background in anthropology myself. So I'm very, like, I love how we've laid this out. But I've been sitting here thinking, you know, basing off the definition of culture and, you know, the developmental aspects of it in the different regions based on, you know, their needs, wants, what's important, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking from the magic aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
how very intriguing it is to me that as many diverse cultures as there are, how very similar the base, the foundation of magical practices around the world truly are.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I'm trying to put these two things together in my brain, and much like my technology today, it's not working out well for me. It seems this, you know, as we're talking about culture and magic, where does the magic, how do we explain that? How do we explain that foundation that almost, it's almost like a purity of a foundation that permeates mm-hmm. culture? It definitely develops differently from culture to culture. But the root of it is, no pun intended, is still the same.
Mm-hmm. Well, from lots and lots of traditions that I have studied as an anthropologist, but also participated in as a magical practitioner, what it really, a lot of it comes down to, and you can see the similarity from culture to culture, is when a group of humans get together and they have wants and they have needs, and they are dependent on the relationship that they have with their natural environment. If you are attuned to that, and you are, you know, where you have to be in order to survive, clear that the realization that you live in an environment not full of dead matter, but full of other beings like you who were put here just like you or evolved here just like you, however your foundation story of your culture tells you, that you are going to appeal to the living energy around you in the form of all of these other beings, creatures, spirits, including ones that you don't see that appear to you in dreams. That seems to be something that's a really, really basic human behavior that does seem to, I don't know if it transcends culture or slips beneath culture, but when you put human beings
almost like
in
we're
in
verging on the nature versus nurture sort of aspect of it.
Well, and those, that argument, when you really look at cultural phenomenon and magical and religious practice, I'll throw religion in there too, because you get a lot of chit-chat in old anthropology books that magic and religion are somehow these two different things. And, of course, I'm pounding my fist on the table and saying, horseshit, they're not. there's a difference between folk religion and institutional religion, but when you get right down to it, praxis, the things that people do to get holy, are really the same. And the distinction between magic and religion was in the heads of white English guys who did early anthropology, who believed that their institutional religions were somehow evolved, and the indigenous religions that the people that they were colonizing were somehow inferior. And so magic and religion in their heads were somehow this these two distinct categories. They are not. We're talking about the difference maybe between practice and theory or praxis and theology, ideology. But magic and religion, you get right down to it, it's exactly the same thing. Just some, you know, some are more localized and some have to be institutionalized in order to do what they do. So, but there does seem to be something, at the bottom of it all. I'm sorry, go ahead, Art.
I was just going to say, you know, the questions are coming fast and furious in the chat. This actually seems like a good place to jump in, since we're kind of at that foundational part of the story. But how therefore is magic learned? And, you know, is systemized magic still magic? Does teaching it rob it of its power?
Not at all. There are forms of magic that are, you know, like I say, indigenous and folk, which is, you know, kind of erupts through a natural relationship with your environment, that are maybe shared in the same way that we share songs and jokes and traditions, not taught in a formal sense necessarily. But you learn how to do magic and have that energetic relationship with your environment in much the same way that you would sit around the fire and tell stories or cook food together or create tools together. It's just part of being part of the culture that you're in and who you are. Is that formal teaching? Plenty of people would say no. There's some theoretical constructs about what kind of learning that is as opposed to formal teaching. But there are also institutionalized forms of magic as well. I mean, Western ceremonial magic comes to mind. That is a cultural form of magic. It is imbued with meaning. And I think anyone who has had any, even their toe dipped in ceremonial magic will tell you that the structure and the correspondences and the complexity of that kind of magic does need an educational structure to pass on this information and pass on these practices that is quite structured. People teach magic all the time. I live in a community where people are teaching magic to each other, both, you know, elders to the young, but also laterally across traditions. It's not the teaching of magic that somehow sucks any gas out of it. I don't think it sucks any gas out of it at all. And magic is like any other cultural tradition, like language or food or custom or dancing or whatever else. It is something that needs to be taught, needs to be learned, but how that culture chooses to do it, that's where the cultural distinction comes in. Is there formal education to do it? Is it, you know, kind of more roll up your sleeves and just live the life and then absorb it? Those are all cultural differences. But magic, of course, is taught. It's particular cultural magic. It has to be in order for it to be, you know, a cultural tradition.
So from a cultural perspective.
I'm sorry. I'm just now looking in the chat and going, holy smokes, there's a bunch of questions in here.
Well, I am at timestamp 1934, if you'd like to join me. But from a cultural perspective, you know, answering yet another question from the chat, you know, in so many religions and I'm throwing religion in too, religions and magical lineages, you know, they call out a requirement for having to pass it on in a particular way. Is this more cultural construct than actual, I guess you can say, natural selection?
Yeah, it absolutely is a cultural construct. I mean, these are decisions that a culture makes about what to maintain with regard to magical practice, what to what's not as important to remember. But then once you decide what it is important to maintain, you have to create some way to teach it and some way to structure it. And again, I think kind of pulling this difference back and forth between is magic somehow this inherent natural thing that we all know how to do versus is magic something that is taught in a formal context? The answer is yeah to both. You know, I think a lot of us, especially if we've grown up in the West, when we hear teaching and learning, we tend to think of the sage on the stage who is bestowing wisdom upon us and teaching us the right and wrong way to do things. And that's not the only way to do things. That's not the only way to educate. That's not the only way to learn magic. Do you absorb it from your culture around you? Do you learn how to do magic? Some cultures, you're kind of tricked into learning magic because it's hidden in the everyday chores of just kind of, you know, keeping the people fed and alive and everything else. A lot of hunting magic is that way, for example. First you learn how to hunt, and then they go, by the way, you've been doing magic, and I'll show you what you've been doing. And, you know, then it's just kind of in your bones. But with regard to, you know, how magic is practiced and taught, I mean, when you get right down to it, all magic is a cultural practice, and all magic has to be systematized and taught and passed on and learned, you know, down the generations. How that teaching and learning happens is a whole other, you know, kettle of fish that has to do with, you know, cultural constructs of cognition and teaching and styles and learning styles and teaching styles. Yeah, I mean, those are all ways to systematize learning. I think thinking in terms of, you know, complex systems is something that the West is particularly focused on. But really, when you get right down to it, there's a lot of indigenous ways of transmitting knowledge that are incredibly complex that would flabbergast us as well. But basically, in order for us to – go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, at what point with the systematization and such does magic become religion? It's a question from the chat, but it's a very intriguing point to me. Because to mm-hmm. me, really, when it comes down to it with religion, it is systemized and codified magic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I am going to sit on the soapbox of there is no difference between magic and religion except the values laid on one or the other by a dominant culture, right? We look at the religious practices of, let's say, in the Aboriginal Australian peoples, tribal peoples of various sorts, and have looked at them and said, oh, what they're doing is magic. They're somehow believing that they can exert some sort of control over their natural world because they're worried about things. Well, if only these people eventually understand that there's one God, and once they accept that and follow our religion, then all their problems will be solved. And they stop all this making of things and wearing of amulets, and they start thinking in terms of heady theological constructs, then they will evolve as people and they won't need this magic anymore. And like, I'm sorry, that's right. That was just pure, you know, cultural bias on the form of a colonizer. Walk into a Catholic church in the West, attended by, you know, people in the Minnesota suburbs here, and you will see the same things, a bunch of people that want some control over their environment, who are wearing amulets, and who are praying to something outside of themselves, or perceived to be outside of themselves, in order to make change happen in their lives or to give their lives meaning, right? The get right down to it, magic and religion are the same thing. And the other thing that kind of, I'll just go ahead, it sticks in my craw as an anthropologist, is this practice of looking at indigenous religion and of magical practice and saying that this is somehow an inferior way to engage with the divine than, you know, studying theology and doing sort of more theoretical religious endeavors, right? I'm sorry, when people are, you know, full for their family traditions and their religions, it's not based on any kind of theological need. It's often sensory, and it's often right down in the everyday the everyday muck of being a human being. You know, there's a really wonderful book that I want to recommend. The author's name is slipping me right now, but it's called The History of Religion in 5.5 Objects. And rather than going into studying religion as this sort of, you know, we'll start here with indigenous religion, and then this Hinduism came out in India, and trying to figure out how to historically talk about how religion, quote unquote, evolved. What they're talking about is that religion for people is a sensory relationship. And the objects that he looks at are stones, bread, incense, crosses, and let's see, it has all five senses here. Stones, bread, taste, incense, a smell, crosses, which is visual, and then drums, which has to do with hearing. And these are kind of basic building blocks, sensory building blocks, that help human beings figure out ways to create meaning for themselves, but also create meaningful relationships culturally, and kind of at the base of religion. You know, if you are wistful for spending a religious holiday with your family, because let's say you're abroad somewhere, you're not thinking of a particular, you know, theology. You're thinking of the food you used to eat, or the songs you used to sing. You know, these are things that are on a very, very basic level. What kind of make a magical or religious culture hang together? I'm going to be that persnickety old professor, persnickety middle-aged professor, who says, you know, when you get right down to it, magic and religion, there is no difference other than maybe cultural decisions.
Mm-hmm. So when we're breaking this down like this, is there truly such a thing from a magical standpoint as appropriated other cultures, you know, practices, or is that just a method of growth or expansion when it comes to magical practices?
And this is another kind of complex area, the area around cultural appropriation and misappropriation. And I always like to tell my students that there's a difference between the two. You know, cultural appropriation happens when two cultures come together, you know, either willingly or unwillingly, whether it's for war, whether it's for trade, whether it's for, you know, when two cultures bang into each other, they are inevitably going to look at the other's culture, and if an idea seems like it's good, they're going to adopt it. If an idea seems like it's bad, they're going to reject it. And this can be done peacefully. This can be done under duress. But syncretism and cultural diffusion, the things that we called what we now call appropriation, right, happen all the time. Misappropriation is where there is a deliberate taking without any sort of education or forethought or respect, just taking something that you barely understand that you think is kind of interesting looking about a culture, ascribing your own meaning to it, and then kind of putting it out there to try to profit from it, right? So I'm trying to think of a really classic example of,
continuing on with a practice in the way that you may have learned it from another culture,
mm-hmm.
is appropriation, but
right.
Say taking pagan holidays and converting them to something that fits your paradigm, that is cultural misappropriation.
Even that gets a little complex, but you kind of have the idea. A lot of the pagan holidays that have become Christian holidays, that in some ways was a combination of, you know, colonial and conquering powers trying to quash pagan holidays, but also kind of accepting we kind of can't quash them all because we just can't keep the power down. and a lot of folks who were folk and pagan saying, all right, we'll play the game of going to these churches, but we're going to maintain our traditions within these Christian holidays, quote unquote, because it's a form of resistance, right? You can there's really a lot with regard to that comes into appropriation too. There's sort of this dialogue that happens between two cultures that are kind of in a complex or an unfair relationship, where the combination of what's pressed down, what's enforced versus what emerges as resistance kind of helps give power and identity to the magic and to the practices of that religion. A kind of a classic example that I think of with regard to this would be something like Haitian voodoo, okay? These were enslaved people that were brought to Haiti. The French colonizers tried to press Roman Catholicism on them, but their form of keeping their African traditions alive from their homeland and their traditions and their relationships with the Nwa, with the spirits, was to disguise them in the trappings of Catholicism, so that when the colonizers thought, oh, they're baptizing somebody in the river, how nice, what they were actually doing was doing a ritual to Danbalawedo and to the other Lwa of the ocean, La Sirene, the other Lwa of the ocean. But, that dialogue between resistance and colonizing gave Haitian voodoo its very, very unique cultural flavor. And now you wouldn't extract that relationship out. Misappropriation is something like Kim Kardashian decides she wants to call her line of lingerie kimono, and then tries to copyright the word kimono. And all of Japan stood up and said, oh, no, you don't get to do that. and again, the bottom of that basically like, oh, it's a cool word and it's kind of neat, I'll just do it, with no thought to what the word means, what culture it comes from, what it signifies. And then, of course, she naturally backed down from that because, you don't want an entire country mad at you, That's sort of, it comes from a place of ignorance, and it comes from a place also of wanting to profit from that. This is another hole to go down. There is something universal, and I'll go ahead and say this, because there aren't a lot of human universals in when you study anthropology, but one of these universals is, you as a human being and your people trying to have a relationship with the world around you that is meaningful and that is more than meets the eye. I mean, any group around the world will tell you that, when they talk about the spirits being present in the environment, or that the trees are alive, or that, the ancestors are watching. The reason that these are so many universal themes in so many of these cultures is because really they're kind of in a position to understand that part of their human experience more intimately. So that urge to have life become meaningful, that it seems to be a universal human urge. I think people that walk around not caring what their life means are kind of entrapped in their own cultural ideas of the only thing that's important is you, and everything that around you is dead, so make as much money as you can and then take it with you when you die, right? So there's that, the human urge that is universal, but the expression of that urge and the practices around that urge are what varies from culture and culture to culture. And of course it's fascinating, and of course we look at other cultures and how they, let's say, do sacred dances or play sacred music or engage in ceremonies and go, that's really wonderful. May I do that too? And if you're invited in by that culture and they teach you and they are happy to tell you about it, then that's not misappropriation. That is cultural sharing, right? And that's how ideas get passed back and forth in a really good way. And of course these blends are going to happen. If you just kind of storm your way in and say, I'm just going to take this from you, that's misappropriation. And that's that's what you try to avoid. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen, right?
You know, we have roughly about 23-ish minutes left in the show. And a lot of questions in the chat that I think really, you know, it kind of carries along a very good consciousness stream along for what we're talking about tonight. I'm not sure if you have access to the chat right now.
I do. I do now. Now that I have my glasses on, I do. So,
at timestamp 1938.
Okay.
Does the diversity of culture lead us to overlook what magic is in some cultures? Might we misidentify magic and subsume it into something our culture likes or what makes social use of it rather than what individuals do egotistically? I'm really intrigued by this question.
That's a yummy question. I like it. I think so. I think there's been many, many stories of people encountering something that they think, this is a really beautiful piece of jewelry. I'm going to buy it and I'm going to bring it home. And it turns out that actually the piece of jewelry, it has magical significance. It was an amulet or it belonged to somebody, and it actually does have magical and religious meaning in that culture, but because we don't have the cultural eyes to see it, we might just see, that's an attractive object made of beautiful things, and don't bring the meaning home with it, right? It's interesting because it can cause you, with regard to the question, it can cause you to overlook what magic is in some cultures, but it also can lead you to believe that things are more magical than they actually are, right?
Interesting.
So, yeah.
That's an interesting side of it that I hadn't kind of considered in that is, you know, taking things that more or less inventing magic from the mundane when it's not really there. That's kind of an intriguing lens to look through as well.
Yeah. Story I like to share with people is that, like, this happens in the arts too, where, you know, a lot of collections of art made in Africa back in kind of late 19th, early 20th century. It also just kind of competes with Western notions of what's valuable too, is that Westerners will come to buy real African art, you know, quote unquote. And what they want is the old stuff, you know, the stuff that's perceived to be more valuable. It's rare. It's old. And those particular cultures are like, it's not valuable if it's old. The magic is already spent. You want this old thing? Fine. We have new things now, and that's where the power is in these new creations, these new pieces of what you're calling art. This is what we value. You want this old thing? Take it. And then Americans or Westerners take it home and go, I've got this ancient, you know, totem, or I've got this important religious thing. Well, actually, you don't. You have something that, as far as the culture that it comes from is concerned, is depleted of all of its value. You know, I don't want to say that it's, you know, this is, you know, trash, but basically, like, yeah, we used it up already. You can take it home and recycle it if you want to. It's the new stuff. And then when folk artists start to carve the new stuff, which is where they put their value, Westerners don't want it because it's new. They want something old and ancient that they can, you know. So, yeah, kind of that dialogue happens back and forth too, where, you know, what's really magical is frequently through the eyes of the culture and the lenses of the culture, but also the use of the culture, right? I'm seeing Paul T's question about Arthur C. Clarke, and I might skip over that one. compromise apprehension of each other. You know, I kind of went on to my bender about magic and science and how they are not the same thing. That might be another show, is to kind of really delve deeply into that too. You know, science is about what is empirically proven and verifiable. Magic is about the metaphoric relationship we have with the world around us. And they don't inhabit the same space. They really don't. There's some science that seems magical. Well, heck, there's card tricks that seem magical that are when you write down to it are systems. And likewise, there are some forms of magic that have the trappings of scientific systems. You know, astrology comes to mind, very systematic. But it's also, you know, beautifully metaphoric. Right? Oh, and then we have what about languages? You know, again, language is a cultural difference. It's a cultural system. And while he's asking a question about anti-linguistic symbolism and glossolalia, and for folks that are not in the know, glossolalia is sort of the various cultural practices of when entranced, sort of divine babbling, for lack of a better word, okay. So sort of the making of sound and noise in a divine place where Pentecostals call it speaking in tongues, other traditions call it talking to the spirits or having the spirits talk through you. Very, very powerful. Whether or not magic and religion comes with a language versus with a lack of language, or whether it comes with noise versus silence, those are cultural distinctions. And whether or not they are, you know, important or useful to a culture is a cultural decision, and then that cultural decision was maintained and passed on. So, I see questions like that as, you know, sometimes they're framed as, is one better than the other or one more powerful than the other? Nope, they all hold that equal weight. It just depends on what culture you're sitting in about which is perceived to be more magical and more important, you know. Chanting magic in Latin somehow more magically powerful than speaking in tongues in a Pentecostal church? No, but when you're sitting in a Pentecostal church and you're Pentecostal, that's the most powerful thing that you can do. When you're a ceremonial magician standing in a circle, that is the most powerful thing you can do. It just depends on, again, where you're sitting and how you're looking. You can pick a question now, Art. What question do you want me to answer in the chat now?
I've been reading them through, and there's so many really great questions. I do want to scroll forward a little bit, too, and mm-hmm. then back up. So we'll play bounce through the chat for a moment.
All right.
Ms. Kat has joined us, and she actually made a very interesting comment around 2008. It says, with the advent of anthropology and museum collections, the opportunities for cultural insensitivity and misappropriation can increase, but so can holding space for oppressed cultures on the brink of extinction. E.g., recordings of Native American speakers being used to re-inform survivors who are stripped of their cultural continuity. And I think mm-hmm. that's a very strong and powerful statement to make.
And very accurate. You know, and anyone who is in, you know, my discipline, you know, anthropology, the social sciences, in museum studies, archiving, all the things we've been talking about, this is something we're very cognizant of by putting things on display for people to contemplate as, you know, objects or ideas that are somehow, you know, other, you know, than what you are. You know, basically, it's things to contemplate separate from their culture. Yeah, there's a whole lot of, through a field museum, an anthropology museum, and listen to parents talking to their kids, you get the idea how clueless some people are when they're engaging the important symbolism of another culture. It can make you a little bit batty sometimes. But at the same time, you know, Ms. Kat is absolutely correct. Sometimes it's in these systems that, you know, when cultural preservation is really needed and the fading of a culture and their magical practices and their religious practices are moving out of existence. When the choice is there to, yes, let's engage in preservation, oftentimes a healthy relationship with a museum or with an archivist or with archaeological companies are really, really valuable. You know, my sister is an archaeologist by trade. A lot of her work is engaging in dialogue with the indigenous communities around here so that when they are working to preserve and document aspects of their culture, they have a say and are on board and are involved with how those decisions are being made too. When it works, it can be great. But we have a pretty crappy history of putting other cultures on display and then ascribing our own meaning to it rather than understanding the context of that other culture. Absolutely. This cat is dead on right about that.
We are going to jump back because there's three really great questions right in a row in our chat. And Troll T has added one just to the chat that I'm going to want to fast forward to. We're down to roughly about 12 minutes. So this is kind of like the speed round of the show.
All right. Here we go. So, I'll be as fast as I can.
So at 1945, does the mechanism of things like sigil magic reduce language away from the practical amulet-making display something important about its acultural aspects?
Okay, I need to read that one again. Hang on a minute. How's the mechanism of things like sigil magic? Language away from Prado. I'm still trying to pull apart that question. I think creating sigils necessarily is reducing language from anything practical. I think when you get right down to it, sigil is art, is the innovative art. I don't think that it's taking magic and language and reducing it. Yeah, I think if anything, it's creating something new. So I need to unravel that idea first. I'll need more of a clarification of that question because I'm not on board that making sigils is reducing the language. It's changing it, but I don't think it's reducing it. Where are we going from there?
A little bit of additional clarification was sigil magic. Austin Osman's Spare, it requires understanding it in that context, his notion of it. Are you familiar with Austin Osman's Spare?
He was my boyfriend in grad school. Yeah, of course. And the thing about Spare, too, that you have to keep in mind is that the man was an artist, you know, by training, in a brilliant one. And while his method of taking phrases and words or images and making them economical for magical purposes, I'm not convinced that that's reduction. It might be distillation, or it might be. I'm not knowing what I know about Spare. I'm not convinced that that's what was going on there. So that would probably be something that if Nagashiva and I were sitting and enjoying tea and really getting into how we see how Spare from his personal but also cultural perspective believed he was doing with sigils, we'd have probably a really, really cool, complex discussion. I'm not quite sure if I'm coming from the same point of view as Nagashiva is on that one. So
I think you floored Nagashiva. He says he was your boyfriend.
It's kind of a joke. I had a report to finish. I wanted to do one on the occult arts, and all I had at the time, this was back when stuff was hard to find, right? And all I had was one book with one illustration done by Austin Osman Sparin, and I knew I wanted more information about this guy, and so walked into a really old bookstore called Renaissance Books in Milwaukee that it was like four stories high and smelled of old books. And we wanted those kind of bookstores. And I just remember just kind of walking through the occult and unexplained phenomena section and kind of going, what am I going to do? I don't know if I can even find any more books on them. And I looked on the shelf and there was this little purple paperback written by Sir Neville Drury, whose work on the occult writing is some of the best. And I was like, oh, great, Neville Drury. And I picked up the paperback, and it was an entire paperback set of essays that he wrote about Rosalie Norton and Austin Osman Spare, complete with illustrations. And I was like, what? You're my new friend. So just being able to kind of throw him at my art department, which is who I was wrestling with at the time, who were not quite sure that what I was writing about and interested in was really relevant in the lenses of what they thought art was, you know, again, cultural difference, to be able to throw Austin Spare at them in his drawings and say, how you like me now, you know, And they couldn't look away because he was such a stupendously good technical artist, right? I mean, he's incredible. I mean, the folks are not familiar with Austin Osmond Spare's artistic work. He was just a deft draftsman, just an incredible artist. They couldn't dismiss him because he was just too good. But they also didn't understand him because he didn't inhabit the world of Western art traditions. So I kind of walked with his books with his pictures in them under my arm, you know, smugly during grad school because I knew something they didn't know. So, Aleister Crowley was my pal, Spare was my boyfriend. I had all these imaginary friends floating around with me in grad school. So that was a branch.
Well,
out of control.
Zooming back to timestamp 1950. Does what they call high magic really represent a classist hoity-toity bias that degradation of elitist appropriators hoping to seize the attention of future generations?
Kind of a loaded question, Steva. See, I'm sitting here kind of going, it's a cultural difference. But, you know, understanding that it is in the lenses of the era of British colonialism, and it, really this bizarre period where, yeah, these sorts of high magical traditions that were sort of kind of, you know, promulgating and maintaining this sort of elevated relationship and learning of languages and skills and kind of elevating was happening at the same time that they were colonizing peoples around the world, England was, and becoming fascinated enough with the indigenous religions or the local religions of places like India and Pakistan and the island nations and all these other places where they colonized, that they found them fascinating enough to want to bring them over to learn about in England while simultaneously trying to convert them all to Christianity, you know, which is what the Theosophical Society kind of embraced, was, well, these ideas in the East are really fantastic. We should take these on and study them more. But at the same time, the colonizers were trying to convert those same people to Christianity. It was really, really weird. So about seizing the attention of future generations, I'm not sure about that. I think they were in it for what they could get presently, you know. I think there are a lot of folks who are practicing those quote-unquote higher ceremonial styles, those complex systems and orders of magic, because they really do legitimately want to attain something meaningful and transcendent and you know, something beyond themselves. I think there's some definite but there's always going to be people who, you know, respond to that sort of complexity and think it's beautiful. And you know, we find some of these folks in pagan circles frequently, those who are trained as ceremonials versus those that are kind of trained more shamanically. You know, there are some that love to have drums and ritual and some that say it gives them a headache and they can't concentrate. Well, that's not just personal preference. That's also, you know, if you've been taught that magic is, you know, performed one way and not the other way, when you know, you encounter the one that's the opposite of what it is that you've been trained in, it's going to throttle you a little bit. And again, cultural difference, you know. A lot of the questions are kind of in the realm of, you know, still is one form of magic, you know, somehow more authentic than the other, right? Either because it comes from a particular culture or particular practices or whatever. No, when you get right down to it, magic is something that is simultaneously totally authentic and simultaneously completely created by human beings based on their cultural preferences. And as long as when you're looking at any kind of cultural human phenomena, religion, magic, anything that's ephemeral like that, as long as you keep in your head that both and rather than either or, then you're kind of understanding how to, you know, engage with human cultural institutions, especially ones like ideology and religion and praxis and magic, because they are both, you know, both and.
That
are you still there?
Excellent point. I'm still here. I'm still here.
My phone made a funny noise.
So we have just about 3 minutes left. Let's clear off the 1951 question here. Is all magic based on the doctrine of signatures, or is that another cultural bias based on religious dogma?
I don't know if it's based on religious dogma, but it is another cultural system. Not all magic is based on a doctrine of signatures. I love the doctrine of signatures. It informs a lot of Western magic, but it was collected from the study of cultures around the world. But there are plenty of cultures whose justifications for why magic works are not in the doctrine of signatures. They have other cultural systems that explain it. So that's the quick answer.
And probably a good question for the follow-up part two of why magic works that we still need to get on the books.
All right. Sounds like a plan.
You know what? I think maybe we can squeeze in one more question here. Trying to read quickly. If religion and magic are identical, are there priests of magic?
I know a heck of a lot of them here in this community. Folks in Paganistan who would definitely identify as clergy, but are not part of any particular religious group. What they are expert at and what they want to teach is magic and method, and whatever religious coloring or influence you want to put on what it is that you're doing, that's on you. You can look through any eyes that you want to, but there's plenty of people that I know that when they dedicate themselves to something, they dedicate it to a practice. Not so much an ideology. So sure, I've seen it and I'd get on board with it. And again, magic is a practice.
Mere seconds.
Yeah. Okay, I'll stop now.
No, I do want to say thank you, Doc Murphy, for bringing this to us. You know, a few moments ago, Reverend James reminded us that we have 5 minutes left in the shower. It's been a wonderful show tonight. The technological gods were shining upon us, and our fingers were flying across keyboards. Definitely, Doc Murphy, we have to sit down and figure out some additional opportunities to join us here on Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places, and possibly in other avenues as well. But that's all the time we have for tonight, folks. I sincerely hope you've enjoyed your time with us this evening. Until next time we meet, keep the magic alive. Take us out, Reverend James.
Thank you, Reverend Art, and thank you, Doc Murphy of RootDocMurphy.com in Paganistan and the Twin Cities of Minnesota for being our guest this week. We invite you to join us next week when we'll welcome another fine guest. We've come to the end of this episode of Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places, brought to you by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company in Forestville, California, on the LMC Radio Network. You can find Reverend Art at PulseHunter.com, on the Lucky Mojo Forum at forum.luckymojo.com, on readersandrootworkers.com, and on Hoodoo Psychics Thursdays and Fridays from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and Saturdays and Sundays from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I am your announcer, Reverend James, joining you from PulseHunter.com in North Carolina. Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places can be heard every week live on Blog Talk Radio at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the shows are available in archives via mysticsmages.com/radio show and on the Lucky Mojo Forum. From all of us at Mystics and Mages, I'd like to thank you for being here. Be sure to follow at Mystics, Mages, and Magical Places on Facebook and at Mystics, Mages, Magical Places on Instagram for updates and news. We'll be back next time. At the same time next week, come to the spell, wink, wink, relax and enjoy the show. We've only just begun. Won't be the first. I mean, wasn't the last. So I'm sure I'll mess up again. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Thank you, Reverend James. Thank you again from the bottom of my heart, Doc Murphy, for joining in today. You know, everybody stay tuned, and we will get some information out to you about when camp is up and running completely. It's just a wonderful show tonight. Last few seconds. Hoodoo Psychics, Magic Mondays, answer the post.